in much more detail, whether you have the picture book or some other source. I'm just giving some modern highlights of areas that are sometimes familiar with, particularly those involving electricity and timers and things like that. So first, let me just review. Let's review the most common situation. You have a refrigerator. And question number one is, when can you open and close a refrigerator? When are you not supposed to open and close a refrigerator? So let's first assume that you did what you're supposed to do, and the electric bulb is unscrewed, so no light is going to turn on. So it really depends, because what happens is that all refrigeration is based on a thermostat concept. So when warm air comes in and the temperature rises above a certain point, and you can set it, it could be 50, it could be 60, whatever you want it to be, the motor starts running. You've activated an electric motor. You're not allowed to activate a motor on Shabbos. That's a malacha. Of course, what is the malacha is not so simple, but suffice it to say you cannot turn on a motor on Shabbos. So consequently, many opinions do have a custom, or many rabbis, rather, advise a person, you should never open a refrigerator door unless the compressor is already operating. If the motor, right, there's a hum, if the motor is already operating, you can open it, but you cannot open it if the motor is not operating because the warm air might cause it to turn on. However, I want to point out that the actual halacha is that you are allowed to open the refrigerator even if the compressor is off. And the reason is, there's a very important principle in the laws of Shabbos. It's so important, I'm going to give it to you in the Hebrew so you'll actually know the klal. The klal is, davar she'eino mitchaven, or davar she'eino mischaven mutter. That means, if on Shabbos you are intending to do a permissible action, but it may have the consequence of doing a forbidden action, you are allowed to do a permissible action even if it may have an impermissible effect, unless it is a 100% certainty that the impermissible action will happen. So, here is the point. Opening a refrigerator door is not an impermissible act. It is a permissible act. It may, by the warm air, cause the motor to start, but that's not your intention and that's not your desire. So even if it may happen, this is what we call davar she'eino mitchaven. Now, let's compare that with where you forgot to unscrew the light. Because you may ask the question, so what, if you're telling me, if I don't intend to activate the motor, I can open the door, then why can't I open the door if the light turns on? I don't intend to activate the light. Difference is that when the light has not been removed, it is 100% certain that the light will go on. You don't have the rule of unintentional action when the negative consequence is a certainty. The term for a certainty is called psik resha. Psik resha is an idiomatic phrase that means cutting off the head. And the analogy is, of course, people had different ideas of toys in those days. The Gemara discusses, I cut the head off a chicken to give the head to my child to play with. It doesn't sound like a great appetizing toy. Well, appetizing maybe it is, but it's not a toy. But the Gemara says, so let's say I say, well, I don't intend to kill the chicken. I just want to get its head. Answer, if it's 100% certain that that's going to happen, it's going to be prohibited. So you understand the difference here. If I open up a refrigerator door and the light bulb is unscrewed, the light is not going to turn on, but I may activate the motor, that is actually permissible under the rule of unintentional action. Davar she'eino mitchaven. But if I open up the door and I know the light will go on, even though it's unintentional, I don't intend the light to go on, that's going to be prohibited because psik resha, when it's a certain consequence, and this is a machlokas, does certain mean 100% or 90%, but it's very, very high. It has to be at least almost certain. So then it's going to be prohibited. Okay. Yeah.
So if you would like leave the fridge open for a while, then it's pretty certain that it would go on, right?
Yes.
So then that would that fall under sick grace?
Yes, that's correct. So the one thing that you need to be careful, you're allowed to open and close your refrigerator. But you try to close it as soon... We're talking about the light is unscrewed. I'm not talking about a light problem. I'm just talking about the compressor. You try to close it as soon as you can so there shouldn't be a buildup of warm air that will vadai cause the compressor to turn on. However, as I say, this is the halacha, but some people are machmir, and maybe you've come across this. Some people are very strict that they will only open a refrigerator when the motor is already running. And you'll see this, you know, periodically you'll hear the refrigerator start up, and when the motor is running, for sure you could open it, because you're not going to activate the motor. So the halacha is you can open the refrigerator even if the motor is not running, as long as you're going to close it fast enough that it's not going to be a certainty. But many people are machmer, so the reason I'm saying it is because you may see at rabbis' homes or other people's homes that they will not open the refrigerator, and that's a chumrah. And I'm not saying that's an improper chumrah. I mean that could be a very proper behavior to have, but if it causes great hardship, you don't have to be that strict. Yeah.
What's the difference between like a certain consequence and an uncertain consequence?
Yes, because the concept is this. In order to transgress doing work on Shabbos, there is a concept, you had to have intended to do the work. So consequently, if something is an unintended consequence, it is not your responsibility. But where what you intend 100% produces the prohibited, then that is included in your intention. Meaning, you cannot say, for example, that when you fire a bullet at somebody, you don't intend to kill them. In other words, the question basically becomes, what is intention? Meaning, if I intend A and B happens, so B is unintentional. But if every time you do A, B is going to happen, then when you intend A, it's as if you're intending B.
So what's a practical example?
Well, the practical example is, and consider the two cases of the refrigerator. This illustrates the rule quite well. Case number one is, I unscrewed the light bulb, so the light's not going to turn on. But by opening the refrigerator, I may cause, by the infusion of warm air, the motor to be activated. So the argument I'm telling you is that since the activation of the motor is not a certainty, we regard it as an unintended consequence of my primary action, which is to open and close the door. Therefore, it's going to be permissible. By contrast, when I didn't unscrew the light bulb, even though it is not my intention to turn on the light, but since opening the door will cause the light to go on 100% of the time, it is no longer treated as unintentional action. It is treated as what is called besik resha. Okay, so if you want to impress your Shabbos hosts, you can just come in and just use the word besik resha. They will certainly give you a double stare. How'd you know that? Okay, because it's kind of an advanced Talmudic term, right? So it's very, very impressive. Okay? Yeah.
Like, the reason why you can't play any instruments is because it might come to break and you might come to fix it.
That's correct.
But there's no psik resha that it will break or that you'll come to fix it.
No, I understand, but that's a totally... Okay, you're 100% correct. But that's a totally different thing. That's not defining malacha, that is defining gezeirah. In other words, we have many, many cases where the rabbis make a fence around the Torah and they say, don't do this, which is technically permissible. Playing a musical instrument is absolutely permissible, because we are afraid that if you're allowed to do this, you will come to do something that is forbidden. So that's a rabbinic decree. You're right. As far as the Torah is concerned, there would be absolutely no problem with playing a musical instrument. You're allowed to do it. Well, psik resha is a rule on a doraisa, but it does permit even drabanan. The rabbanan did not. Well, I'm sorry. When it is a psik resha, then it becomes a doraisa prohibition. That's right. Psik resha is a doraisa prohibition. Exactly right. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned this last week. You know that most Reformed synagogues go by the term temple. They're called temple. Why are they called temple? So this actually goes back to the beginning of the 1800s, that one of the first things the Reformed synagogues wanted to do is they wanted to introduce the playing of an organ or a musical instrument for Shabbos services. And their argument was that in the Beis HaMikdash, the Levim did play music on Shabbos, and they said that since every synagogue is a miniature Beis HaMikdash, you're allowed to play music as well, and that's why they called it temple, so you would connect it to the Beis HaMikdash, which is temple. That actually was the halachic justification that they utilized, and then of course it just became kind of the name for a reform synagogue. Okay. Which is interesting that in the early years of the Reform movement, they tried to justify halachically what they were doing, as opposed to simply saying, we don't care about halacha and the like. Okay. All right, so this is how it works when the refrigerator light is unscrewed. Okay, so you can open and close, but some are machmir, they will only open when the compressor is already on. You hear the motor humming. Okay. Now, what happens if, God forbid, you're in the difficult situation where there's this light that you forgot to unscrew or whatever it would be, and what's going to happen is you open the refrigerator door and the light turns on, and actually what sometimes happens is a reverse. You thought the light was unscrewed, you open it, the light's on, and now you're not supposed to close it because you're putting out the light, and that's also prohibited. So what do you do? So here I'm going to mention two ideas. Both of them depend on having a goy. If you don't have a goy, you're kind of in trouble here. If you have a non-Jew, now remember the general rule here. The general rule is you're normally not supposed to ask a non-Jew to do work for you on Shabbos. That is a general. In other words, please do not assume that you can just ask non-Jews to do things for you. But when it comes to refrigerators and Shabbos food and things that are very necessary, we do have certain leniencies. And that is, you are allowed, you don't even have to hint, you are allowed to directly ask a non-Jew to open and close your refrigerator. Okay, that's an important rule. I can ask a non-Jew to open and close my refrigerator on Shabbos because Psik Resha is a principle that's only forbidden for the Jew. It's not forbidden for the Jew instructing the non-Jew. Now, the question that, and that's true even if what the guy is getting is not something that's so important, meaning it's not my basic Shabbos meal, but it's a dessert or liquor or something that is not essential. Now, the question, again, I probably said this last week, but just to be sure, the question is, that the guy's not going to be around all day, so I would like to ask him, when he opens the refrigerator, to unscrew the light bulb so there won't be a problem. Am I allowed to ask the non-Jew to unscrew the light bulb so I'm not going to have a problem? So this is much tougher. To open and close the refrigerator, you can just ask him no matter what. But if you're asking him to actually unscrew a light, which is turning off a light, directly, not by opening and closing the door, but by unscrewing the light bulb, you can only do so if later you will not have a guy to open and close for you, and the food that you need is your basic Shabbos meal, as opposed to your luxury items. Okay? So in other words, so if it wouldn't be your chones wouldn't be in the refrigerator, I guess, but whatever it is, your chicken, your fish, your challah.
What is the basic meal? Because I thought according to the actual rules, it's like a piece of bread and wine.
Yeah. Well, you'll survive. No, but when we say a basic meal, we mean a basic meal that is an honorable respect for Shabbos. So we define it in a much more generous way than we might during the week. So it's not just bread and water. Okay. It basically includes chicken or meat, whatever your main course is, and bread. Wine, bread, and main course.
Okay.
So if, for example, you had your chicken's already out, but it's the side dishes that are in the refrigerator, then you would not be allowed to ask the guy to unscrew the light bulb. But you still would be allowed to ask him to open and close the refrigerator. Okay? So you see the difference here. You can ask the guy to open and close the refrigerator for any food that you want, any item that you want. But to unscrew the light bulb, you'd have to have what's called basic Shabbos meal, which is wine, bread, and main course. Right, that's called the definition of a basic Shabbos meal. It would not include dessert or side dishes. Okay. Now, the big problem, though, you're going to ask is, okay, I don't have a goy, you know. I mean, Baruch Hashem, we're happy we don't have that many Arabs around here. You know, who am I going to... I'm in Israel. Who am I going to ask? Right? So if you don't have a goy, one option that you might consider is to pull out the plug with the shinoi, because think about it this way. Let's say, now here you have to bedafka wait when the compressor is off. When the refrigerator is off, it's off, so you're not going to be stopping a motor. The refrigerator is off. The door is closed, so the light is off. Pulling out the plug is not turning off a light, and it's not turning off a motor. The only thing is, it is muktzah. Normally it is muktzah for you, right? You're not allowed rabbinically to handle plugs. But muktzah that you move in an unusual way is permitted. So what you should do if you don't have a non-Jew is, with your foot, if you can, you can't always manipulate it, wait until the compressor is off, there's no motor operating, and then kick the plug out of the socket with your foot. And when you kick the plug out of the socket with your foot, you can then open and close the refrigerator. Now, there is a risk, because that means you don't have a refrigerator that's working anymore. So theoretically, food could spoil. But usually, you know, it's cold enough in a refrigerator, can't promise you, that if you don't open it and close it too much, the food will normally be okay. Essentially, it's equivalent to a prearranged power failure at that point. Okay, that's what you can do, right? So that's what you do if you forget to unscrew the refrigerator light. If there's a guy, you can ask the guy. You don't even have to hint. Open and close, no problem. You can ask the guy to unscrew if it's your basic Shabbos food. And finally, if there's no guy, no matter what, you can wait until the motor is not running, and then kick the plug out, and then you can open and close the refrigerator. Now, I do want to warn you that all of these heterim, well, this last heterim in particular, only works when you have a simple refrigerator, which simply has a motor, and the motor is either on or the motor is off. When you have modern refrigerators that have all sorts of computerizations and digital readouts and everything else, then even when the compressor is off and it's not generating coolness, there's all sorts of readouts and digital things that you are disconnecting when you unplug it, so you would not be able to do that. Not only that, you might not even be able to open your refrigerator. So do not get fancy refrigerators. Because if you get a fancy refrigerator, you might not be able to use it on Shabbos at all. Because, I mean, let's imagine this. Some refrigerators have digital readouts, meaning as soon as you open the door, there'll be a readout that will go, let's say, from 54 degrees to 58 degrees. And as soon as you close the door, it'll go from 58 to 56. You cannot open and close that refrigerator no matter what, because everything you do is going to have lights turning on and off and numbers reading, right? So be very, very careful. This is a very important problem. You know, you want to get the nicest, you know, model, you know, the best. Go to a used appliance place and get a 1950s refrigerator. Number one, they're big. And number two, they don't have all of these difficult Shabbos problems. All you have to do is unscrew the light bulb, and you're going to be okay. In modern refrigerators, it's very, very, very difficult to use them on Shabbos. Yeah.
There's modern refrigerators for Shabbos mode.
Yes, that's correct. There are because of this, there are Shabbos modes that disable all of the bells and the whistles and the lights and the readouts and the like. So. that would work as well. So at least be sure that you have Shabbos mode. And if you, God forbid, didn't buy a Shabbos mode refrigerator, there are engineers in the religious world who will do it for you. I mean, you pay them, but they can convert your either your stove or your refrigerator into Shabbos mode. But of course, there is a legal problem, because usually if you get people to change your appliance, you have voided the warranty. So be careful about that. So if you want a warranty or something because it doesn't work, you know, you've lost your warranty. Same thing with the computer. Anytime you tinker around with something, you lose the protection of the warranty. Okay, so that's what a little bit of what you need to know about refrigerators. Now let me mention another question. So tonight are going to be quick, assorted questions. And that is the use of a Shabbos timer. Right, these are ubiquitous. Right, we have timers. We have Shabbos clocks, timers. In Israel, they're actually sometimes built into the building itself, you know, a Shabbos timer. And turn on the lights, turn off the lights, turn on the air conditioning, turn off the air conditioning, turn on the heat, turn off the heat. Right, we have all of these different timers. And under Torah law, timers are perfectly fine, because let me emphasize, the Torah prohibits you from doing malacha on Shabbos. As long as you set up some automatic process before Shabbos, min ha-Torah, there's no problem. Do you understand the conceptual basis of timers? Even though lights are being turned on and off, they're being turned on and off automatically based on what you set before Shabbos. And the Torah does not say malacha cannot be done. The Torah says you cannot do malacha. Now, there is a problem though. Rav Moshe Feinstein, the great Rav Moshe Feinstein, was actually against timers. Because here was his argument. We know that under Torah law, I could tell a guy to do work for me under Torah law. But the rabbis prohibited my telling a guy to do anything that I can't do myself. Because even though I'm not doing the work, the guy is doing the work, but I'm causing the work to be done. So Rav Moshe Feinstein made an interesting argument that he said the same principle that you can't have a non-Jew do work for you should also apply to you shouldn't have timers do work for you. Because yes, on a Torah level, we agree. On a Torah level, it's not malacha. And on a Torah level, telling a goy is not malacha. But if the rabbis forbade amira la'oved kochavim, that means telling a goy to do work, then logically they would prohibit timers. So this was Rav Moshe's position, which was a very strict position. And I have to say, interestingly enough, in spite of Rav Moshe's greatness, and Rav Moshe was considered to be, even by the Rebbe, considered to be the definitive posek in the United States, but Rav Moshe's position is not widely accepted, as you know. The minhag of Klal Yisrael is that we do use timers for all sorts of things, and we base it on the idea that I'm not doing malacha. Malacha is being done on an automatic basis. However, let me point out that even with timers, there are some things you should not use timers for. Let me give you a few examples where you're not allowed to use a timer on Shabbos. You cannot use a timer to water your garden. Let's say you have a sprinkling system. I have a garden sprinkling, and I have an automatic timer that turns on the water at various times. It is totally forbidden to use your sprinkling timing system to water. Well, first of all, this year is Shemitah, that's a whole other problem, but I'm not talking about Shemitah, I'm just talking about Shabbos. You're not allowed to water your garden on Shabbos. Now, why is that so? Because since that is public, that is done outside, it is improper to have anything that is a Shabbos violation done in a public way. For the same reason, although the reason is not so clear, you are not allowed to use a dishwasher on a timer to wash dishes. Let's say I put my dishes in the dishwasher and there's a timer that turns it on. Because since dishwashers make noise, this is a bit strange, since they're noisy appliances and they make noise for a long time, for the whole cycle, that is treated like a public desecration of Shabbos, even though it's in your kitchen. and therefore that's improper. So no timers for dishwashers, no timers for sprinkling systems.
Yeah.
What if the garden is in your house? And what if the dishwasher is very quiet?
Yeah, well, there is room to be lenient there, but I think the custom basically is that we look at this in terms of general categories, not specific cases, since most gardens are outside. Most dishwashers are noisy, so we don't make individual exceptions here.
Okay, garden is something that usually is outside, but yep. Dishwashers is something that's changing. Like, machinery is becoming more quiet.
Well, it might be. Again, as I say, the classic postscript have always said not to. But you know, it's interesting if we ever get to a case where most dishwashers are really quiet. And by the way, washing machines would be the same principle, right? You can't wash clothes via a timing mechanism.
That's really quiet.
Huh?
That's really quiet.
It depends. Our machine is pretty noisy. I don't know. Okay.
You say that the dishes you have some like Shabbos. Need for them, like
okay, that could be a different. Yeah, yeah, I mean, you're correct. There's a separate issue of not preparing for Shabbos, but the washing dishes.
Not preparing for Shabbat?
No, not preparing on Shabbos for after Shabbos. But the dishwashing thing you're not supposed to do, even if you're washing it for Shabbos itself, because of the idea of making noise.
What about an alarm clock? Does that make some noise?
You are correct, and there are some people that do prohibit alarm clocks on Shabbos. But on the other hand, it all depends. If you have an old-fashioned manual alarm clock, even though it's making noise, there's no malacha being done. So the making noise is a problem when there is a malacha, like dishwashing is the electric, you know, an electric appliance turns on. A manual alarm clock.
On your phone. Set it and it just goes off the
phone. So that is a problem. Some say that that's forbidden, and others say that they say that unlike dishwashers that could go for a long time, alarms are made just to be for a very short time, so we don't make the gezeira for short term noise. But it is a problem. It's not at all obvious. Logically, it should be usher. Sometimes the logic isn't carried through in all of these cases. The other thing is you cannot use timers to cook on Shabbos. Meaning, think about this. Why can't I just put a raw chicken in the oven and the oven will turn on by itself? I'm not going to turn on the oven. Now, you can use a timer to warm up already cooked dry food. That you could do, because there's no prohibition of cooking, but you cannot use it to cook something raw or something liquid that was uncooked, right? So there are certain things you cannot use timers for. As I say, dishwashing, laundry, you cannot use it to water a garden, and you cannot use it to cook raw food, although you could use it for rewarming. But timers can be used for lights. They can be used for air conditioning. They can be used for heating. Okay? So these are kind of the general rules of timers. So now, the question...
You want to take out a timer like you did with the fridge, with your foot or something?
To do what?
Like when the timer's off?
Oh, so that's what I want to talk about right now. So now what I want to talk about is this. Let's say I have a Shabbos clock, a timer, and I want to change it. I want to change it on Shabbos itself. I want to change a setting. So the question is, am I allowed to change the settings of timers on Shabbos? So I'm going to tell you today the psak of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And basically, it all depends on what type of change you want to make. Some changes you are permitted to make, and some changes you're not permitted to make. So let's go through a few examples. Let's say my Shabbos clock is set to go off at 11 p.m., meaning the lights are going to go off at 11 p.m. And I have some guests who are going to, it's going to be a longer meal, so I would like to change the setting, turn the dial. So instead of going off at 11, it'll go off at 12 midnight or 1. Okay? So what am I allowed to do that? So Shlomo Zalman Orbach rules the following way. You are allowed to make any change that is extending the existing situation that it's in. Meaning, if the lights are on, you can change the clock so they will go off later. But you cannot change the clock so they will go off earlier. Because you would be causing a light to turn off earlier than it would. So, if it's set to go off at 11, I can change it to 12, but I cannot change it to 10. Okay, you understand? In other words, if it's on, I can enable it to stay on longer. Now, this depends on the clock, but I'm talking about a standard Shabbos clock. I'll explain that in a moment. But I cannot cause it to go off earlier. Now, the other way around. Let's say the lights are already off. The lights are already off. And they're scheduled to turn on at 7 a.m. I am not allowed to do anything that will cause them to turn on earlier, like 6, but I can delay their going on to a later time. Which means it's a relatively simple rule, although the lumdus is complicated, the theory is complicated, and that is, in whatever matzav it already is, you can prolong its matzav. Matzav means its condition. So if it's on, you can cause it to stay on longer and go off later, but you cannot cause it to go off earlier. If it's off, you can cause it to stay off longer and go on later, but you cannot cause it to go off earlier and turn on earlier. Okay? Now, this is Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's psak, but there's another condition that we have to talk about. And that is, the condition is that Shabbos clocks are muktzah. They're items you're not allowed to handle. So when you manipulate these dials, you must do so in an unusual way, meaning to say you don't just do it in the normal way that you do it, but you use your knuckles or your elbows, or you find someone, your teeth, you do some unusual way. And of course, it's a Dover Pashut. Remember, under no circumstances can you unplug the Shabbos clock and then put it back in. That we're not talking about. We're talking about the clock remains plugged in and you're just turning a dial, and you turn the dial with a shinoi to avoid the laws of muktzah. Because muktzah is a separate, right? Muktzah, just be sure everyone just understands. I'm not going to go over the laws of muktzah. But the concept of muktzah is a series of rabbinic laws. Muktzah is not a Torah law at all. And muktzah simply means that the rabbis developed many categories of items that you're not supposed to even handle on Shabbos, but they did permit you to move it in an unusual way. Okay, so very often with Shabbos clocks, you both have malacha problems causing lights to turn on early, and you peripherally have muktzah problems. So you still got to deal with the muktzah problem, even if the malacha problem is okay, because of the nature of the adjustment. Now, let me point out that the heter I'm telling you is for a standard Shabbos clock. You know, the one that all you do is turn a dial. You know, just turn a dial. There are some older Shabbos clocks, and I guess you could still get them, in which you actually unscrew. You have to unscrew unscrew screws, and they actually stop working. And then, you know, then you turn them on. And those you cannot adjust at all, because in the very process of adjustment, you are turning an electrical appliance on and off, or off and on. So we are not talking about those Shabbos clocks. We are talking about the Shabbos clocks that all you do is turn the dial to the appropriate time. Okay? Does everyone understand Rav Orbach's psak? Again, I want to point out that Rav Moshe Feinstein, who didn't like timers anyway, happened to be strict on this as well. He said timers cannot be adjusted no matter what. there too, though, in other words, he has like a 1-2 punch on timers. No wonder you shouldn't even use timers. And then if you use timers, you're not allowed to adjust them. That's Rav Moshe's 1-2 anti-timer pesach. Here I would have to say, though, that the minhag that is followed by most Torah Jews, I'm not telling you not to follow Rav Moshe. If you want to be strict like Rav Moshe, you know, that's certainly wonderful. But most people are not as strict, and they disagree with Rav Moshe on both points. They use timers, except for, you know, laundry and dishwashing and watering the garden and cooking. They use timers, and they will permit the adjustment of timers if it is prolonging the status quo. It is not creating a new situation. It is simply keeping the existing situation longer. Okay, yeah.
I don't understand how turning it doesn't change the electronics.
Well, it actually doesn't, because when the light is on, okay, when the light is on, the circuit is already created. Now, it's set that when the dial reaches a certain time, the circuit will be open. So when you switch the dial, you're just delaying the time when the circuit will be open. You're not creating an electronic circuit. The electronic circuit is already here.
So the movement of turning the dial itself...
It does not. Absolutely not. There is no electricity in moving the dial. The moving the dial is just when...
Unless you do what?
Well, yeah, you could shut, then you shut it off, then you can shut it off around, yeah, but if you're just delaying the time, there is no electronic activity that's occurring there. It's a total mechanical movement. Yeah.
Well, if you have a charger without a phone and no light,
yeah,
would you be able to take it out of the plug? Like, despite the fact that it smokes it, but like...
Well, I would say you could not, and the reason is because unlike a refrigerator where the compressor is not working so it's off, the charger is really on. There's just no phone in there, meaning the charger is, there's an electric connection there that's pumping electricity, and you're disconnecting it. So you are disconnecting the flow of electricity. I think, in other words, I'm trying to think, maybe I have to know better how a charger works. But I'm assuming that the
like
charger...
Like, let's say an oven.
Yeah.
You know that, like, you want to take out the plug so you'll be able to turn on the gas on a Yom Tov?
Yeah.
So would you be able to take it out on Shabbat?
Yeah, except for Muk. So yeah, that's similar to a refrigerator when the compressor is not working, because at that point...
Well, that's the same as a charger, no?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the question is whether there is... I have to see how a charger works. I mean, the problem basically is, if electricity is flowing through a charger...
Will it be also flowing through the core of the oven or the refrigerator?
I think not. In the case of a refrigerator, when the compressor is not working, putting aside the new digital refrigerators, then the circuit is disconnected. There is no flow of electrons. The flow of electrons occurs.
Yeah,
when,
but does it occur yeah. at the fridge or at yeah. before it comes into the cord?
No, we're talking about what is coming into the fridge. There are no...
It could stop in both places.
Yeah, but you're not interrupting a circuit. In other words, you're not... The electrons are flowing into the refrigerator, but when the compressor is off, there is no flow of electricity into the refrigerator.
Same with the charger, no?
But there is a flow. I understand, but well, I don't know. That's what I don't know. I don't know. In other words, I don't know. I'd have to look at how a charger works. Again, if the charger is like the refrigerator, it would be permitted. Mm-hmm. If the charger is like an appliance that is electronically charged, then you would not be allowed to do it. I'd have to see how a charger works. I'm not sure about it.
It does say, like, on your phone sometimes, like, take it out of the plug because it's already full and like save energy.
Yeah.
So it seems like it does, like, but that's when the phone is connected. Maybe when the phone is not connected, it doesn't, like...
Yeah, that's a possibility. Obviously, if there are lights, you couldn't do that, right? If there's a light in the charger that you unplug, the light goes off, So that was what I'd be prohibiting. Okay, I'll check it out for you. Just how the charger works. Okay. All right. So that's now. Let me mention. There's an analogous issue, and hopefully you see it's really the same principle regarding the adjustments of thermostats for heating and air conditioning. Let's take an air conditioning case, and I'll give you a heating case. Let's say you have an air conditioning, and it's not even on a timer, it's simply on a thermostat. So the thermostat is set to turn on the air conditioning when you reach 75 degrees, meaning when it gets hot, you know, when it gets as high as 75, the air conditioning turns on. Okay? Now, let's say you are either a person who doesn't want air conditioning, or you're a person who wants air conditioning to trigger at a lower temperature, even 70. Right? That's kind of where I am. You know, I like air conditioning at 65. So the question is, you want to change the thermostat. Now, first of all, it really depends on what type of thermostat you have. In some thermostats, every time you change the temperature level, there'll be a digital readout. It'll read digitally, electronically, 75, 65. Those you cannot change at all, because any change is immediately going to change the letters, and it's both writing and it's also electricity. But if you have old-fashioned thermostats, the thermostats I grew up with, all you do is turn a dial, right? There are numbers, printed numbers, 75. You just turn a dial to a number. And those dials do not create any electricity per se. It's just turning a dial or a switch. So we apply Rav Auerbach's same analysis. And that is, if the air conditioner is already blowing, but it's going to turn off when the temperature is below 75, and I want to keep it blowing until the temperature is below 70, I can turn it from 75 to 70 while it's blowing, because all I'm doing is prolonging the existing matzav. On the other hand, if the air conditioner is blowing and it's going to turn off at 75, and I want it to turn off at 78, in other words, it's getting colder, and I want to move it to 78, which will cause it to shut off earlier, I'm not allowed to do that. Okay? Now, if the air conditioner is off, right, I am allowed to raise the temperature so it won't turn on until it gets hotter. But I'm not allowed to lower the temperature because I would be causing it to turn on earlier. With heating, it's the exact same thing, except the temperatures are the opposite, right? Heating is activated when the temperature goes below a certain level. So if the heat is on, I can raise the temperature, meaning I can raise the thermostat so the heating will be on for longer. But I cannot lower it to cause the heating to shut off earlier. If the heating is off, what I can do is I can lower the temperature so it won't turn on until later. I cannot raise the temperature that would cause it to turn on earlier. In other words, figure out these configurations. Rav Auerbach's psak is you can always increase the status quo of the matzav that you have, but you cannot cause a change to occur earlier on Shabbos, and once again, because of muktzah considerations, all movement of thermostats or Shabbos clocks have to be done with a shinoi. But remember, in the case of thermostats in particular, most new thermostats cannot be adjusted in any way because they will immediately have digital readouts, electronic readouts, that you're not allowed to change on Shabbos, right? So technology is not always an unvarnished blessing. Technology makes it much more difficult. I don't know if we have thermostats on Shabbos mode. We have refrigerators and stoves, but not necessarily air conditioning and heating thermostats. Okay, and then you understand the basic klalim in this area. Okay, so. So as I say, we're really doing quickie little pieces here. So now, let me talk about another totally different question that we touched upon a little last week, but I want to add a few details. We were talking about last week, briefly, actually it came up in questions, but I really wasn't talking about it, but you had asked, the mitzvah of Tosefes Shabbos. What is the mitzvah of Tosefes Shabbos? That in addition to having to keep Shabbos, Kadosh Baruch Hu gives us a mitzvah that we should add on to Shabbos, both before Shabbos and after Shabbos. And this, according to some opinions, is a Torah commandment that we have to add to the profane from the holy, meaning add to the holy, mikodesh, onto the chol. And we do this before Shabbos, and we do this after Shabbos. Even when Shabbos is over, you try to have Tosefes Shabbos. Now, insofar as the Torah is concerned, Tosefet Shabbat can be a minute. Actually, Rav Moshe says 2 minutes. In other words, Shabbat, when does Shabbos begin? Shabbos begins at sunset. So, once it's sunset, you're not adding on to Shabbos. That is Shabbos. Shabbos is, depending exactly, but it's around 25, 26 hours. Because let me explain the way this works. Shabbos begins at sunset, but it's not over until the appearance of three stars. And here you need to know this, that sunset is called Shkias HaChama, the setting of the sun. But the emergence of three stars is called Tzeis HaKochavim. And the period between Shkia and Tzeis HaKochavim is called Bein Hashmashos, that is translated as twilight. Right? Because Shkia and stars, and in between is twilight, called Bein Hashmashos. Shabbos begins with Shkia, but it doesn't end until Tzeis HaKochavim, which means Bein Hashmashos is treated like Shabbos at both ends. The Bein Hashmashos of Friday is treated like Shabbos, and the Bein Hashmashos of Saturday night is treated like Shabbos. Now, how much time is there between Shkia and Tzeis HaKochavim? So this depends totally on the time of year, and it also depends on your latitude. The closer you are to the equator, the shorter is the period of twilight. The further you are from the equator, north or south, twilight is longer. That's why you may notice, in New York, from the time of the setting of the sun till you see stars in the sky, is longer than it is in Israel. In Israel, it's very short. In Israel, it gets dark really quickly. Right? As soon as the sun sets, it gets dark very quickly. So in Eretz Yisrael, according to the strict halacha, Shabbos is actually over 35 minutes after sunset, although our custom is we do much longer. In New York, it would be at least 45 minutes, and many people wait 72 minutes. I'm not here to give you a psak on that. Obviously, you have your practices, whatever the Rebbeim tell you to do, but I want to tell you the following. In order to fulfill the mitzvah of Tosefet Shabbos, you must accept Shabbos before sunset. Because once it's sunset, you can't add on to Shabbos, it's already Shabbos. Now, it could be 2 minutes. In fact, lichvenching, by definition, is a good acceptance of Shabbos, whether it's 20 minutes before sunset, or 18 minutes before sunset, or in Yerushalayim, 40 minutes before sunset. That's Tosefes Shabbos, you've accepted Shabbos. When do men accept Shabbos? So men, if they don't light candles, commonly do not accept Shabbos when their wives light candles. But they accept Shabbos when they say L'cha Dodi. Right? Because it's called Kabbalah Shabbos. Right? Kabbalah Shabbos, accepting Shabbos, is a fulfillment of Tosefes Shabbos, adding on to Shabbos. Now, here's the question. How early can you accept Shabbos? Can I accept Shabbos on Sunday? Can I basically say, I want to accept Shabbos. I want to have my whole week as Shabbos. Right? I want to do Tosefes Shabbos. So the answer is you can't do it that early. And lich benching and acceptance of Shabbos cannot be before a period of time that is called plag hamincha. What is plag hamincha? So again, I'm actually giving you the definition of the Alter Rebbe Shulchan Aruch, which is the, this is interesting, the Vilna Gaon agrees, so it's interesting that here you have Hasidim and Misnagdim come together on this, although there are other opinions that argue. Plag hamincha is an hour and a quarter halachic hours before the setting of the sun. What do I mean by halachic hour? This is called Shos Manios, a bit of a complicated idea. You calculate the number of minutes between sunrise and sunset, divide by 12, and that is the size of a halachic hour. Let me give you an example. There are 2 days a year where you have exactly 12 hours between sunrise and sunset. Those are called equinoxes. You have one equinox in the spring and one equinox in the fall. On those days, you have exactly 12 hours. The sun rises at 6 a.m. and the sun sets at 6 p.m. On an equinox day, a halachic hour is the same as a regular hour. It's 60 minutes. But you then have two other days of the year. One day is the longest day of the year, like in June, and the other is the longest night of the year, in December. Those are called solstice days. You have the summer solstice, and you have the winter solstice. And then in between, in the winter, generally, the days are shorter than the nights. In the summer, the days are longer than the nights. So I'm going to make up numbers because I don't have the exact numbers here. But let's say in a solstice, you may have sunrise at 4 o'clock in the morning and sunset might be at 8 p.m. So how many hours do you have in the day? In that type of day, you have, actually I don't think this is a day that's that long, but you actually have what, 4 to 4 is 12 hours? You actually have 16 hours in the day. So this is what is interesting. If you have a 16-hour day, how many minutes are there in a 16-hour day? So multiply 60 minutes by 16. And you have 900 minutes. Divide 900 minutes by 12. Okay, what's 900 divided by 12? Seventy-five. Meaning, I'm making up my numbers for the longest day of the year, but just take my example. Meaning, in my example, the definition of an hour is not 60 minutes. The definition of an hour is 75 minutes. This is a very important principle that the Rambam articulated. And that is, the definition of sha'a, hour, is not 60 minutes. A sha'a is 1/12 of daylight time. And in a long day, an hour could be 75 minutes. Now, let's take the shortest day of the year. I'm going to make up my numbers. The shortest day of the year, sunrise might be at 7, and sunset might be at 4. Like the winter. So how many hours do you have between 7 and 4? You have 8 hours. How many minutes are in 8 hours? 60 times 8. You only have 480 minutes. Divide 480 by 12. You get 40 minutes. So a halachic hour on the shortest day of the year is only 40 minutes. A halachic hour on the longest day of the year is 75 minutes. A halachic hour on the equinox is 60 minutes. And then, in the winter or the summer, the halachic hours will be shorter, or the halachic hours are longer, But in all cases, the way the Alter Rebbe interprets all of these opinions, and the Vilna Gaon as well, you are calculating from sunrise to sunset. Now, this is very important for a lot of things. This is how you calculate the time of Shema, which is 3 hours of the day. It's not 3 hours of 60 minutes. It's three halachic hours. This is how you calculate Amida. And the same thing for Shabbos. You can light candles no earlier than an hour and a quarter before sunset. If you light earlier than that, it's a bracha levatala, and you cannot accept Shabbos. You cannot light before plag hamincha. But when we say an hour and a quarter before sunset, we mean an hour and a quarter halachic hour, not an hour and a quarter 60 minutes. Now, which means, if your halachic hour is 40 minutes, so an hour and a quarter is 50 minutes, because a quarter of 40 is 10. So you can only light 50 minutes before sunset, or later, which is almost the normal lichtbenching time of Yerushalayim anyway. If you're in the summer, you have the solstice, and your halachic hour is 75 minutes, so 75 plus a quarter of that is how much earlier, okay? So this is what we mean by plag hamincha. Yeah.
It's like, I don't know,
let's
go with it, it's the shortest day of the year, yep. So then the halachic hours during the day are really short?
Are short, yep.
Are the halachic hours during the night really long? Like, is it different?
Yes. That's a very good point. As the halachic hours of the day get shorter, the halachic hours of the night get longer. But it happens to be there are very, very few halachos that depend on the halachic hours of the night. The overwhelming halachos are based on the hours of the day. Zmanei tefillah, zmanei kabbalah Shabbos. So basically that's the concept. The reason why I keep on mentioning the Alter Rebbe is because there are some other opinions that say you count the daylight hours from dawn to the stars coming up, as opposed to sunrise, sunset. And what do they say? What the Alter Rebbe says and what the Vilna Gaon says is the most widely accepted, and that's what you would follow. Okay? So this is important for plag hamincha, that you need to know, if you're going on a trip or whatever it is, how early you can light Shabbos candles. It's not like you can light Friday afternoon and everything is going to be fine. Now, of course, there's another problem. Let's say you're going away. Let's say you're going to eat at somebody's house, and you want to light candles before you leave, and you're going to take a taxi or a car or a train. The buses are still running, or the light rail is still running. So one problem is the following. I'm going to ask two questions. Number one, where do you light when you're a guest? I guess it's something you probably face all the time. Where do you light candles when you're eating in somebody's home? Now, if you're eating and sleeping there, there's actually no question. You of course light there. You're eating and sleeping there. But what if you're eating there, but you're going back to your dorm room or your house or your apartment or whatever it is? Where do I light candles? Do I light candles where I'm having my meal? Or do I light candles in my home, in my house? So the truth of the matter is, there are different minhagim. There are opinions that say that the ikar place where you always light the neros of Shabbos is the place where you're having the meal in honor of Shabbos. So even if you're not going to sleep there, you would light, or you would have the balat habayis, you know, light for you, or you'd light yourself, etc. There, but other poskim say that it is always better to light in your home, even if you're not going to be eating there, provided you stay at home long enough, or the candles burn long enough, that you will get some benefit of the candles after Shabbos starts. Now, the question then becomes, let's say I'm following that view and I'm lighting at home. Since a woman normally accepts Shabbos when she lights candles, are you allowed to take a taxi, or drive, or take a train after you lit. So the short answer is, normally when a woman lights, she should accept Shabbos. But if she does really need to travel, so there is a heter, which is not the best heter to use, but there's a heter that when you light, you have intention, and you should actually verbalize it, that you do not intend to accept Shabbos with this lighting of the candles. This is called making a tanai, and although lechatchila, it is best that a person not make such a tanai, but in cases of great difficulty, it is permissible, so a woman could make a tanai. Now, the only thing is, interestingly enough, a woman cannot make a tanai if she's making a Shechiyanu blessing, meaning if you're lighting for Yom Tov or Yom Kippur, by making Shechiyanu, you've automatically accepted the Chag. So a tanai doesn't work for Shechiyanu, but it does work for Lahadlik Ner Shel, Shabbos, and the like.
What if it's Shechiyanu Shabbos Kodesh? Does that make it?
No, that wouldn't change it. Even if you say Shabbos Kodesh. Why, you had heard that Shabbos Kodesh would make a difference? I don't think so.
No,
because
the word is added so that you're accepting everything.
Well, I think that's a little bit of a chiddush. And besides, if you explicitly verbalize that you're not accepting, so even if you said the word Kodesh, it wouldn't, you know, you've already said that you're not accepting. So that would be the main thing. Yeah.
So I was once at somebody's house. They lit, and then they had in mind not to take on Shabbos, and then they took a taxi to the Kotel.
Yep.
That shouldn't be done.
Well, it shouldn't be done, but once again, as I say, I mean,
L'chatchila,
you should not do that. That's correct.
So
L'chatchila,
they shouldn't really do that.
That's correct. Normally, that is the case. I don't want to say about that particular case. I don't know, but normally, you try very much not to do that. People take advantage of it too much. People, they light, and there are people who make this condition like every week, and this is not intended. This is intended for like emergency situations. So, if, for example, you know, the place where you're going to eat is like 10 miles away, whatever it is, and you know you're not going to be able to make it, so then you can make it tonight. It's like an occasional emergency situation, but you don't plan it. You don't plan these types of emergencies. Now, of course, if you're going to like where you're eating, that may solve the problem. Totally, yeah.
Is it just Minhag that you have to light at your own home, like, or somewhere that you eat? Because I don't know. Like, I've usually lit where I'm having services.
So let me just say one thing about it. That's the one place where for sure you shouldn't light. Meaning, the idea is, I guess, that the Shabbos candles have to be lit where you reside. But there's an argument: do I look at your residence where you sleep, or am I looking at your residence where you're eating? So there is a machlokas, do you light in your home or do you light with your host? But for sure, just to light in the synagogue, that's not good.
Okay?
It's only a choice between where I eat and where I sleep. That has to be the two places. Same thing with Hanukkah candles, by the way. Hanukkah candles, you are not, in fact, this is a famous criticism people have of Chabad, it's a very beautiful custom. You know, Chabad has all sorts of, public menorah lightings. Beautiful things, White House and here in the downtown here, and they make a bracha, and people raise questions because wait a second here, Hanukkah candles too have to be lit in your home, either where you're eating or where you're sleeping. So when you're lighting outside in the park, that's not a home. Some people may live in the park, but most people don't live in the park. So some people argue bracha levatala, and they say Chabad shouldn't make the bracha.
Well, if you eat there something small, that's enough.
But even then, it's not the designated place. But some people make the argument that Hanukkah might be different because we do light Hanukkah candles in shul, and we make a bracha, which means Shabbos we wouldn't do. We would not light Shabbos candles in shul, but we light Hanukkah candles. So the argument is that it's a makom where the public gathers. So Chabad's chiddush, which obviously was the Rebbe's psak, was that any place where people gather, will have the halachic status of a Beis Knesset where we do light. Others say no, that was a special rule only for Beis Knesset, you don't apply it to other Makom Tziburi. Okay, so that's a machlok. Again, but all of that is Chanukah, that's not Shabbos. Shabbos candles, right, even Chabad doesn't light Shabbos candles in the park, right? That they don't do. Shabbos candles have to be where you live, but we have a machlokas, is that where you eat, or is that where you sleep, right? Different minhagim, so you can follow your minhag, whatever you do is going to be okay, but it cannot just be in the shul or somewhere else. Yeah, I'm sorry, Jeff.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, alrighty. Now, here's a question that is more in America than Eretz Yisrael, and that is, we had mentioned the idea, there are two rules that you need to know. Again, some of this might be repeating. Rule number one is, very important rule, that's when there is only one shul in a community, one minyan, and a lot of Chabad houses are that way, or whatever, you're in a city with only one shul, Orthodox shul, and they accept Shabbos early, like in the summer, they'll daven at 6 o'clock, you are not allowed to start Shabbos later than the congregation. If the congregation starts Shabbos early, you are bound by the congregation. You cannot make your own. Even if you know you're going to start Shabbos well before sunset, so you're going to start it on time. If they started it early, you are bound. This is the rule that individuals are bound by the congregation. However, this rule applies only if there's one congregation with one minyan. If there are other shuls in the sound, even if you don't go to them, but they're there, or within a shul, there are several minyanim, like many synagogues will have an early minyan and a late minyan, then even if you normally go to the early one, you know, it doesn't make a difference, you can decide, I don't want to be Makabel Shabbos early this week. Right? You can switch around. So this rule that the individual is bound by the congregation is only if there's one congregation with one minyan and not if there are multiple options.
But if they start too early, like before an hour and a quarter, then you're not bound, right?
That's correct. That's a very good point. That's a very good point. And by the way, this is actually a mistake that some synagogues make. You know, I'll give you an example. Some synagogues, these are Orthodox synagogues I'm talking about, they will have a uniform. They want to make a simple schedule. So they will say, every Friday night throughout the summer, we will daven at 6 o'clock. Now, in some days, that may be before Plag HaMincha. So it's totally invalid. Their Kabbalah Shabbos is invalid. So at that point, you're not bound. 100% correct. A rabbi has to be sure, and you can see it's easy to do, you know, with computer printouts, it's very easy to figure this out. When is sunrise? When is sunset? What is an hour and a quarter halachic hour? And be sure that they don't accept Shabbos before that time. It's very important. Okay, now, question number two. Let's say that there are many minyanim, so I'm not bound by anybody, I could accept Shabbos whenever I want. But I'm the husband, I like to go to the early minyan. So my early minyan accepts Shabbos, let's say 6:30, but sunset is not until 7:30, so it's within the hour and a quarter. Can my wife continue to do work in the house, vacuuming, whatever, and she wants to light candles regular time, which in the States tends to be 20 minutes before, 18 to 20 minutes before sunset. And she'll accept Shabbos then, but can she do work after I accepted Shabbos in the shul? Now, here we have another principle. And the other principle normally is that women are supposed to follow the customs of their husband, right? You know this. And this is whether to be strict or lenient. For example, if an Ashkenazis woman marries a Sephardi, she could eat rice on Pesach. Right, so that's a great advantage of dating Sephardim, right, if you like rice. If a Sephardic woman marries an Ashkenazic man, she cannot eat rice on Pesach, right? She's obligated to keep the customs of her husband. Yeah? No, that's not obvious. That's actually a very, very good question. And it comes up a lot. I'll tell you what it comes up a lot. It comes up a lot. Well, kidneys might be a problem. It might be a potential. But it also comes up in Nusach HaTfila. A girl was raised, whether it's Nusach Ari or Nusach Ashkenaz, whatever it was. This is her siddur. She's been davening this way for 20 years. And she gets married. Would we say she has to change her siddur? She has to change her tefila? That would be very difficult. You're not used to it. So we do say in those areas that he could give her authorization to follow her minhag. Yeah, she is given that right. And in Nusach HaTfila, that's very, very common, especially. So the question becomes, is a woman bound by the man's early acceptance of Shabbos, or can she wait until regular lich benching? And we're talking about there are many minyanim, so you don't have a problem of being bound by the shul. So here we have a big machlokas. Some poskim say, hey, if a woman is bound by her husband's customs, if he accepts Shabbos early, she's accepted Shabbos early, so she has to light candles before the time that he accepts Shabbos. But Rav Moshe Feinstein here has a very lenient, interesting view. And this is, listen to what Rav Moshe says. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, the rule that a woman has to follow her husband's customs is only if the husband is doing it for a religious motivation. If he's doing something for a religious motivation, so she has to follow it. But when the husband is doing it for a convenience motivation, that does not have the status of minhag. That is not a minhag, that is just convenience. Now if you think about it, why do people like to go to the early Shabbos minyan? It's not because they're such tzaddikim, they want to accept Shabbos early, but it's because they don't want the dinner to, you know, start at 10 o'clock at night, especially if they have children. So Rav Moshe's argument is, if the Kabbalah Shabbos of the husband is a matter of convenience rather than halachic principle, the wife does not have to accept Shabbos at that point, and she could wait until regular candle lighting, which again in America tends to be 18 to 20 minutes, whatever it would be, and she could accept Shabbos then, which means in the interim, between the husband's early davening and lich benching, she is allowed to do malacha. But Rav Moshe has one important qualification. He says, he cannot ask her to do something specifically for him. Meaning, if I come home from shul and I've already accepted Shabbos, my wife could still vacuum and cook and light candles, but I cannot ask her to do something specifically for me because I've accepted Shabbos, so I cannot tell her to do something for me.
Could a woman ask her husband to do something if she accepted it beforehand?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, if she lit candles. Yeah, that's the opposite. Right, yeah, again, you're pointing out that very often you have an opposite situation. I gave you a case where the man accepted Shabbos before his wife, but often the wife accepts Shabbos before the man, because if the wife accepts candle lighting and the husband is still going to drive to shul, and he's allowed to do that because he does not have to follow his wife's acceptance, so she could ask him to do something for him. Yeah, but the other way, not. Okay? Yeah.
Sorry, I'm out of legs up, but when the community accepts it earlier for convenience, she's still bound.
Yes, yes. You're hitting on it. These are very good questions you're raising, because Rav Moshe's distinction is only a between convenience acceptance and halachic acceptance is only a distinction in husband-wife minhag. But in community minhag, we don't make such a distinction. Well, there's a certain power of a tzibur. When a tzibur does something, Hashem kind of gives that a power, even if they're doing it for convenience. It's a very good point. Rav Moshe's distinction does not pertain to the congregational acceptance of Shabbos. It only pertains to the husband's acceptance of Shabbos. That's why I said that Rav Moshe is talking about there are several minyanim, so the wife is not bound by the community acceptance. Okay, so that's what you need to know about what is called Tosefes Shabbos.
What's defined as a community, like the city?
I would say the definition of a community is are there synagogues within a walking distance of where you live? It's not necessarily the city. I mean, New York City, you know, to be a community that includes, you know, part of Long Island and Queens and Brooklyn and Manhattan. We're talking about your community is where you could walk to on Shabbos, even if it's a long walk, etc. Mm-hmm. That's how we would define your community. Okay. Now, as I say, in most American towns that have a strong Orthodox community, there will always be more than one shul, or even if there's one shul, there'll be more than one minyan. But as you pointed out, some Chabad houses, they're the only thing, so you're going to have this problem of being bound by the community's acceptance. Okay. Okay. Websites on Shabbos. I don't know if any of you have your own website or you sell things on the web, but you know, people do it, and the like. And here is the question. If I have a website and the website sells merchandise, I sell paintings, I'm a painter, I'm a clothes designer, I'm a retailer of sorts, and people go to my website and they place orders and they give credit card, they give a credit card information, am I allowed to keep my website open on Shabbos? Now, I'm not going to look at it until after Shabbos, but am I allowed to have a website open on Shabbos, or must I close my website on Shabbos? So it's interesting that although it is certainly virtuous to close your website on Shabbos, absolutely, and you should, but as a matter of strict halacha, the poskim have made a very interesting distinction. It actually depends on who is the majority of your users. If you have a general purpose website, you're not selling Jewish stuff, you're selling general stuff, and most of the people who use your website are non-Jews, then you are actually allowed to keep your website open, even though they'll be putting in orders and Shabbos, as long as you do not process the orders on Shabbos. If, on the other hand, you have a Jewish website, you sell Sforim, your art scroll, right? So you must close your website for Shabbos because most of the customers who would be placing orders are Jews, and you're not allowed to cause them to sin by placing orders. Art scroll, yeah, it does. Now, there is a difficult problem, though, because if you think about this, based on the international dateline, I don't want to go over all of that, how many hours a week is it Shabbos somewhere in the world? It's actually 48 hours.
Wow.
Shabbos is not, in other words, Australia, because when it's Shabbos here, it's not Shabbos there. There are a total of 48 hours where it is Shabbos somewhere in the world. So the question is, when I shut down my website for Shabbos, let's say Art Scroll, right? Art Scroll is in New York. Do they keep it shut down when it's Shabbos in New York? Or do they also have to include Shabbos in Israel? Because if they include Shabbos in Israel, they're going to have to keep it shut down another 7 hours. Because it's Shabbos in Israel 7 hours before it's Shabbos in New York. And if they include other countries, they'll be out for 48 hours. So it's interesting that the psak that they got is that they only close the website for the time that it's Shabbos in the place where their business is located, that they are not chayav to take into account that people from Israel might be, non-religious Jews from Israel might be submitting orders when it's Shabbos in Israel. I'm not sure I understand the logic of that. It seems to me that if you're concerned about causing Jews to sin, you'd have to take into account wherever Jews are, maybe not Antarctica, but you know, certainly Chiloni Jews in Israel. But their psak is that they just have to close for Shabbos hours in New York. Yeah.
Two questions. If a website is like a Jewish information center,
yes.
But do they have to close on Shabbos? Is there people that like, show up on Shabbos and use their website as a source of information?
Okay, so here's an interesting distinction. If it is an information site that people will find because they're doing web searches anyway, then there would be no isser because you're not causing any sin because they're surfing the web anyway. But it's they're not ordering something. They're not doing any transaction. But if, on the other hand, it would cause them to write an email, which it might, right? It might cause you to write an email. Or if some people go to the computer knowing that this information site is open, and they wouldn't go to the computer otherwise, then there is a concern. So I think realistically it should be closed down. Now, I don't know what the Chabad practice are. I've never checked it on Shabbos, so I honestly don't know what it is. But I'm sure they close the business sites, the whatever you can order, Svarim. I'm sure they close them on Shabbos. Whether the information, well, actually it's interesting. I'm going to give you one more shaila, and then I think we can go back, and this might be a good answer to this question. That is a very famous question that people face all the time. Whether it's Chabad, non-Chabad, the yeshiva world, it's a very, very important question. And that is, inviting a guest for Shabbos, if they're going to violate Shabbos by driving and the like. Because remember, there is a rule that you're not supposed to cause people to sin. And if you're not supposed to cause people to sin, and you invite them for Shabbos, you might be causing them to sin, right? So what do you do in such a case like that? Now, on the other hand, if you take the position, I will not invite anybody who will violate Shabbos, then a lot of people are never going to have the opportunity to become religious, because what makes people religious is experiencing Shabbos. So if you're saying, well, hey, I can't invite you if you're going to drive, then they'll never experience Shabbos. Right? Big problem. What do you do? So there are, like everything else, there are many opinions, but the basic guidelines are this. The basic guidelines are that you offer them the opportunity to stay. You have to give them the possibility of accommodations. And that has to be real. It's not a fake. Meaning you have to genuinely say, you know, you're welcome to stay. We'd love you to stay for the whole 24 hours. If they then say no, you are still permitted to have them come. And even though they're committing a sin by driving, but the concept is that in all likelihood, they would be driving to the mall or to the movies. So there is a concept, this is a tricky concept, you have to be careful not to abuse it, that if the goal of their desecration of Shabbos is that it will lead, or it may lead, you don't know for sure, to keeping a full Shabbos in the future. So essentially, you are allowing an Aveira now in order to create the potential for greater mitzvos in the future.
But
yeah,
couldn't that be the same with a Jewish educational website? Like, if they don't get the information.
No. So now, that's exactly my point. So now I want to go back, and that is exactly the same argument that I can invite the person who drives because this will help them keep Shabbos in the future might be an argument in favor of the informational websites. Now, it would not allow commercial websites. You don't have to sell your stuff on Shabbos. But a person gets information where there's a minyan, where there's a shul, where there's a Shabbos meal. So that could be the basis of a heter. Let me give.
It's not time bound. The Shabbos meal is time bound to Shabbos for the information website. You can look on Sunday.
That's right.
Maybe they'll search show Chabad House and then go there. Search online where it is.
No. I think you're saying the same thing. So that's why you need the informational service, because that's information for Shabbos itself.
No, but you could look on Thursday. Like Shabbos, you can only experience on Shabbos.
No, I understand what you're saying. I understand the difference. But on the other hand, if you're talking about somebody, you're talking about a non-religious Jew, and the non-religious Jew wasn't inspired until Saturday. So to say, hey, we're not going to give you the information on Saturday because you should have checked on Thursday. Well, maybe he didn't know there was Shabbos until Shabbos, you know. But I see what you're saying. But still, you can't look at a non-religious Jew and say, you should have been inspired earlier, you know. Yeah.
Also, if a person owns like a radio station,
yeah,
could they program it for Shabbos? Like, it keeps playing songs. Let's say, like, it's a
Yeah.
There are like Jewish radios
on. Yeah, them. Yeah, yeah. Unless you can fit it into this model of causing Shabbos observance, it is absolutely improper because you're causing Jews to turn on their radios. Again, you know,
what if it's like bearing in mind that, like, when it's, for example, like, when Shabbos starts in Australia,
yeah,
it's like really early in the morning for some people,
yeah,
on Friday,
yeah.
So let's say they're updating it with like Jews in Australia in mind that when the Jews in Australia are finished Shabbos, they can listen to the radio.
I understand, but I think it may depend on who the predominant audience is, meaning who is your primary target audience.
Jews. Like,
no, I understand Jews, but the question is, if it's Jews in Europe, then you have to follow those hours. So,
what if, like, primarily people who keep Shabbos check your website? So can you assume that most people check will be.
Yeah, but on the other hand, what's the benefit of having it on? In other words, if your customers.
Yeah, because other countries can check it.
Oh, okay,
like
okay,
if you have a
okay,
website,
okay, okay, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, it would seem that if the people who use your website are mainly Shomer Shabbos, you would not have to shut it off, even in your Shabbos target area. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a very good point. Now, let me just mention another. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, what if you are running like a bank store or like an ATM machine or like a, you know, those Coca-Cola machines?
Yep, excellent question. A simple vending machine, right? A low-tech vending machine. I have a Coca-Cola machine, right, or an ATM machine, and people are using it on Shabbos. Do I have to shut off my vending machine? So here, the Poskim said the same idea as the website. In fact, this was the precedent for the website. It goes before the internet. That is, if it's in a place where most of your customers are non-Jewish, you can leave it running. If it's in a place where most of your customers are going to be Jews who will be violating Shabbos, you're not allowed to do it. So if your vending machine is in Harlem, like, you know, it's mutter.
If is that another way out, like maybe selling it to an Arab?
That might be so. You might be able to sell it. Yeah, that's correct. It might be like operating any business on Shabbos that one could sell. But you could not own the machine, and you might not be able to keep the money that came in on Shabbos. You'd have to make a cheshbon. That would have to go to the person that you sold the business to. He would get the Shabbos money. Let me give you one example of this idea that we sometimes allow a sin right now because it may cause greater mitzvah in the future. That's the inviting the person who would drive on Shabbos. There is a law in the Shulchan Aruch that says you are not allowed to give food to a person if they're not going to make a bracha, because you're causing them to sin. You're causing them to eat without making a bracha. That's a din. I cannot offer food to somebody if they're not going to make a bracha. Now, I could tell them to make a bracha, that would be fine. That's the nice, best thing. But if they're going to refuse, I can't do it. Now, imagine this scenario. I have an air conditioning repairman who comes to my house in the middle of the summer. It's 105 degrees outside. He's schwitzing and sweating. He happens to be not religious. He asks me for a glass of water. I say no. What is he going to think of religious Jews? He will think that they're mean and cruel and inconsiderate and selfish. So his hatred of the Torah is going to be much worse than the sin of not making a bracha. And by contrast, you show him hospitality, you show him friendship, he will have a positive attitude towards Yiddishkeit. So if Shlomo Zalman is not a chassid, or Shlomo Zalman Orbach ruled, it is better to give him a positive feeling about religious Jews, even at the expense of not making a bracha, than to give him a hatred of Torah Jews. Because if he has a positive view of Jews who keep the Torah, he might eventually be attracted to looking into mitzvot and the like. So you don't drive him away, right? So it's a similar idea to let somebody experience the Shabbos. Even if they're technically going to violate it, as long as you give them the opportunity to have a place to sleep, because that could foster Shmirat Shabbats in the future. Yeah, the other, we had a question? Yeah. No. No, okay. Okay, any final questions? Yeah.
I mean, practically, if you are the rabbi knows it's an Ava community and you have people over for Shabbos, you can't
yes.
offer all of them to, you know, to speak.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, yeah, excellent question, but you have to be honest. You should not invite people unless you have created the theoretical possibility that they will all be able to stay. You shouldn't overbook. It shouldn't be like an airline that overbooks people.
So is that based on, is that a predicate, like, you have to sort of do that?
Well, yeah, because you can't do something that compels them to violate the Shabbos. You have to create
yeah,
a situation.
Most
guys
tend to look closely,
what? Oh, no, you're right. That's a very good point. Meaning like this. We're only looking at the people who are not within walking distance. So I can invite 500 people if I have accommodations for 20 people and 480 can walk even if they're not going to. Yeah, that's a very good point. We're looking at, when I said you can't invite more people than you can accommodate, I meant you shouldn't invite people beyond the walking area, beyond that you can accommodate. Now, if you give general invitations, like you put an invitation in the Jewish press or something, that's very different because you're not specifically targeting those people. They just go on their own. But to specifically invite people that you know are going to drive, when you don't have an option, they don't have an option of either walking or accommodation, that would be improper.
So the concept of keeping doing the sanah for keeping the mitzvah later, that sort of comes second.
That's correct. It's a combination of two ideas. That number one, you are giving them the ability to keep Shabbos even now, and number two, there's a long-term benefit. You're combining both. By the way, that's why there might be a difference between a kiruv program like a Shabbaton and a social event like a bar mitzvah. That's an interesting question. Let's say you're making a bar mitzvah and you're just inviting everybody. You know, if it's not going to be kind of an outreach type of program, it's not so simple that you should just invite people. That's why I know that some people make bar mitzvahs for their children during the week now. They don't make it on Shabbos because they want to minimize the desecration of Shabbos. Anyway, in Eretz Yisrael, bar mitzvahs are much more low-key than they are in America. In America, they make a tremendous deal. What do they say? More of the bar and less of the mitzvah. But okay. Okay. So we covered a lot of assorted little things. But I hope this will help you. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask. Okay. So you all have a good day.